The following is a presentation of Morning Drive Media.
Broadcasting from beautiful, sexy, steamy Studio City, California, this is the Knapsack Files. I'm Ken Knapsack, and this is another edition of the interview, the classic Knapsack Files interviews, what launched this feed to begin with. Thank you for supporting and listening to the Knapsack Files podcast feed. Guys, I have a wonderful guest, and I'm going to start off big. I'm going to not bury the lead. When I first met this man over at Defy Media and Screen Junkies, we were bringing him on board to do some work with us, and one of my good friends, Jack Conway, wrote me and said, "You're hiring this guy? Smart move. He's a genius."
Yeah.
Here is the genius, Lon Harris.
Oh, so kind. Very kind. What a liar Jack Conway is.
You, sir, are, I don't even know how to pin you down. You're definitely a writer. Above all other things.
I try.
You've turned into a little bit of a personality because of your exposure on so many Screen Junkies and Screen Junkies Plus shows.
At this point, I popped up on a few, more than a few.
You're controversial.
Today, especially, yes.
And you're overall just a great dude.
Oh.
And a good break room conversationalist.
I'm an excellent break room conversationalist, yeah.
Yeah.
That's my personal brand.
So what technically do you do at Screen Junkies now? You do a lot of other things, which we're going to get into, but that's where I know you most.
Yeah.
And what is it? You're writer, researcher, producer, everything.
We say writer, researcher. I have sort of taken on more producing kind of duties on a few of the shows. Definitely now. Movie Games and What's in the Box, which is Movie Games is our trivia game show. What's in the Box is Kevin Smith and Jason Mewes Open Toys.
Right.
I'm sort of producing those at this point, I would say, on some level.
And here's the strength of Lon, if you're listening and you're trying to get to know him better. If Andy Signore would say, "Hey, you know, we need a title for a show," I'd come up with maybe one or two. Joe Starr would come up with three or four or five. Spencer would throw some great ones in there. And then Lon Harris would come up with 50 possible titles. Have a preternatural ability to just come up with things.
I think it's
when did that begin?
It's a lack of having any kind of filter. Like, I was always the guy, even like in high school,
right?
Even a little before that, where I just was constantly trying to throw out jokes and be funny.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time, that's people you're not funny. I'd be the guy who like tries to do a voice and does it really bad, and everybody like makes fun of him because like, how could you think that you could do Yoda? You totally can.
You totally cannot.
But I just don't. I just never cared. I just never had that weird gene of or whatever. I lack that gene.
The filter gene?
Yeah, well, just to like, everybody's going to laugh at me and it'll be embarrassing for a second, and then everybody will just remember that something funny happened. Yeah, that's always been like, I did stand-up for a little while.
I was going to ask you if you ever done stand-up.
Yeah, for like 6 months. I used to.
That's plenty.
I'll tell you. Yeah, I'll do the story. I used to go to lunch at Barney's Beanery because I had a job right up the street. And there was a waitress there that we used to get all the time. And she was really cute. I liked her.
Okay.
And she did stand-up comedy.
Hmm.
And she did the thing that sometimes people do if you say a lot of dumb jokes, which is like, "Have you ever done comedy?"
Yeah.
So I sort of went just to go hang out with her for a while. She never developed any interest in me.
Sure.
But I did enjoy doing comedy for a little while, so I tried it for a few months. But yeah, I just lacked the discipline.
The discipline to prepare sets or do it every night? Or
no, the
what?
Writing jokes, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
I would have binders, whatever, notebooks full. It was the discipline of, showing up every night to get on stage, waiting around for 2-3 hours if it means you're going to get your 5 or 7 minutes on stage. And like the people I know and the people I was even seeing then who got really good, who got like good the way I would want to be good, were just killing it. Like would go to 3 open mics a night, 6-7 nights a week, which is always, every time you talk to them, be like, "Well, I can't tonight because I'm going
hit a set."
You know, right? I got to go to La Siena again. Then I'm going to this place. I got to the lesbian bar at 11 has a half hour. Like literally,
I got an open mic.
It was called Oasis.
Oasis.
And the lesbian bar used to do open mics. So I just was not. I knew I wasn't that guy, and I was just like, I don't want to like half ass it. So I sort of gave
that
up.
That was the point I hit with stand up too. Is I just knew I looked ahead. Like, if this gets to successful, where I would quote want to be, what is that life?
Right.
And that wasn't the life.
Right.
I
mean, certainly, if you're talking about, and I have like great respect. I don't mean to like knock this.
No.
I love a lot of comedians, and I think they're amazing, and I respect what they do. But I couldn't. If it was like tomorrow, I got to go to like Montana and then Idaho. and I'm going to go to Ohio, and I don't know how long I'll be in Indiana. Like, I just, that's not me. I was never going to be in
your homebody. Are you?
Yeah, but I never minded getting on stage. That was never the thing. And I would talk to other people like, oh, so nervous to go up. Yeah. The very first time I ever got up in front of a room full of people and did comedy, I was not nervous at all.
And this is just this weird filterless life you've been living since child. Now, you're a California boy, right?
I grew up in Philadelphia, but only until I was 10. Yeah, we lived in Philly.
Oh, I didn't know you had an East Coast.
Yeah, 10. Connection. And then my parents were just like, sick of the snow, and my mom's brother lived in Los Angeles, and they were just like, let's move to L.A., and my dad found a job, and we moved to Orange County.
So that, O.C.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I grew up in Irvine.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting, though. So you have 10 years is enough time to spend on a coast to soak in that atmosphere and attitude.
Yeah, no, I mean, a lot of my sort of perspective was already formed by the time you're 10, and it was all growing up, Philadelphia.
What kind of kid were you? Were you the wise-ass kid, or were you the quiet kid learning the jokes? I mean, you talk about this filterless life.
No, it was really high school was when I got, like, loud. Like, oh, if I'm just loud and I just, like, yell things and try to be funny, people will pay attention to me. I'll get positive reinforcement.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, before that, I was real small when I was a kid. Like, I was tiny. Okay. And scrawny and always really like uncoordinated. Like, I'm always really like unathletic.
Yeah.
But mostly because, you know, when you're a kid, it's not like you're out of shape.
Yeah.
I was just like bad at that stuff. I was bad at shooting baskets, bad at swinging a baseball bat.
Yeah.
And I was like bad at kickball.
Did you want any of those things?
Desperately. Because my dad was a big sports guy and a sports fan and like to play catch with us and like really wanted to foster that, and I wasn't into it.
And you have a brother, right?
I have a younger brother.
Right.
Who, he got into, like, watching sports, so they'll, like, watch Flyers games.
Because I know you're not a big sports guy.
No, well, I think this is why. Like, I think it was because I was so uncoordinated, I just lacked that ability to do it, that it just got associated in my head with being discouraging. Like, I was just... I was good at, like, I could read a book and impress an adult by talking about it, and I, like, would love movies, and people would be like, oh my god, this kid knows so much about movies. That was where I got all my positive reinforcement from, whereas baseball was like, oh, this ordeal I had to go through.
That's a great perspective. I ended up having both, but the sports thing kicked in later, so I thought that was it, and then I had that moment where I couldn't swing a baseball bat as good as the other kids.
I mean, those are the memories of childhood that burned in my brain of, like, very kind, patient adults just trying to walk me through it. Like, all right, no, well, we got to work on your stance. You got to slouching. And I can't.
Elbow up.
I really do. I've had that feeling a lot of, like, that I'm like, it's like the alien controlling your body. Like, other people, like, I watch athletes or something, and they're so graceful.
Yes.
And it's like, it is like I'm a different species from those people.
It is. Like when I watch pro wrestlers do some stuff what they do now, the flippity-flop stuff going high in the air, the body control, I just, you know, and I'm not horrible at it, and I'll hit the gym and I can throw a ball, but there, you can just tell I don't have those genetics.
Yeah, and it's just like the reflexes and the gracefulness. I was watching, it's a weird example. I'm taking it to a weird place. I was recently watching the ESPN O.J. Simpson documentary.
Yes.
And the first, like, hour is mostly just him as a running back, like, it's before he's murdering people. And he is just watching him, like, I never, you know, do I know? I knew O.J. Simpson from Naked Gun movies.
Sure.
But watching him, like, just like, he could do that, like, sideways jump through. It's just like, how, like, I could never, even if you gave me 45 minutes to just plan to it out think, once and time it perfectly, it I couldn't do it.
Couldn't.
And he's doing it in an instant.
So then by that regard, with the sports on the side, at what point you're talking about adults and you love movies and your opinions, at what point did that start to click in? Is that a path in a direction?
So early with movies, like, really soup, like, before I remember it consciously happening. Like, my parents told me the first time they took me to see a movie was, like, that animated Disney Robin Hood, you know, with the fox that now has become sort of sexy.
A weird sex symbol.
Yes. that was, like, the first movie I saw theatrically, and they were like, you were just like, I stood up on the chair, like, I couldn't believe it, even back then. Like, I was, like, 3 or 4 years old. So that's all, like, I just remember growing up, and I was always the kid. Like, a lot of kids loved movies.
Sure.
But I was, and it was different, too, because there was, like, no internet, or, like, like, movies were, like, a thing you did on the weekend, but it was, like, movies and bowling and roller skating, and there wasn't really, like, it wasn't different. It was just, like, weekend stuff.
Yeah.
But I was the only one where I was like, I want to watch movies all the time. Like, it's all I want to talk about and think about, and it's what I was into, and there's the toys I was into. And
across the board, you liked everything? Did you hone in on specific genres? Because you're so well-rounded.
Now, yeah, but comedy. When I was a kid, especially, it was just kind of like funny movies. And my brother, too, is 4 years behind me. So, like, by the time I was, like, 8 or 9, and he was, like, 4 or 5, and we could both start to watch things together, that was when it really got immersive, where we would just watch comedies constantly and quote them to each other and like memorize them.
The classic 80s ones or just...
Yeah, well, I mean, definitely Three Amigos was a huge movie for us as kids. Everything Mel Brooks, like Spaceballs was definitely one that was like big. Princess Bride, I know we love. Ghostbusters, I love Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
Goonies, Gremlins, like a lot of those 80s.
Oh, man, we grew up in a good era.
Yeah, I mean, right, and it was and it was this time in sort of film comedy, because also like National Lampoon a little bit, like where movie comedy all of a sudden was taking this like weird, everything was getting like weird and dark and creepy.
Yeah.
And I was like right there in that groove, like Beetlejuice, like right there in that groove.
Right.
So that was my stuff growing up.
So you're hitting into that stuff, and then at what point does this become a career choice? At what point did you ever consider anything else?
Oh yeah, I mean, I was like, I always wanted to do movies and be a writer, like from the time I was a little kid. But it was, you know, also I was in Philadelphia, so
born and raised in
Los Angeles. It's sort of a lot of people around work in movies, and you're sort of aware.
Seeps in, yeah.
But I had Jewish parents in Philadelphia, and it was like, you will be a lawyer. I mean, it's great that you love movies.
That's cute, kid.
When you have your law practice, maybe you can represent a director. Like, that would literally be like the kinds of things they would say. Because it would just not occur to them that, like, you know, that's a fulfilling. I think even to this day, they're like, we were right. You probably should have gone. Like, if you ask them even now, they'd be like,
They see your car.
I mean, it's kind of like, working, but not, let's be honest.
It's not really working.
Law school would have been.
So did you consider those things at any point, or were you zeroed in early on?
No, it was real. I mean, even in high school, you know, I still didn't think I was going to, like, make movies. Like, I thought I would be like, maybe I'll find a way to, like, write in whatever job I have. But I thought, like, journalist. Like, I really thought journalist for a long time. Like all my teenage years, I thought I would grow up and I would work for a newspaper, and maybe I would be like a movie reviewer or something, or maybe I would just be a news writer or whatever. And I always liked politics and news and followed that stuff too. All through, even into college, I sort of thought journalism. And then it was like the late 90s when I was in college, and all of a sudden it was like, oh, there is no, journalism's over, oh, there is no more, oh, okay,
I'm screwed.
And that was really like when I first got out of college and I was trying to get jobs at newspapers, they were like, no, okay, you know what I'm saying, we just fired everybody. Like, literally, you're walking in as people with their desks in their boxes are walking out. It was the timing was
so you had no choice to kind of move into the comedy writing.
Yeah, no. Well, oh, but even not back then, no.
Yeah,
years
no.
Later, no.
Yeah. Would you meander around doing
that? I graduated college in 2000. Okay. I graduated UCLA, and I thought I was going to get a job for a newspaper, and I didn't. I ended up working at Barnes & Noble for a year.
So close.
I moved home. I worked at Barnes & Noble on the info desk. You know, like, Dante's Inferno, it's back here, let me take you there. And I did that for a year, and I lost my mind living in Irvine with my parents.
Yeah.
I moved back in, I did post-production for a while. I did subtitles for DVDs for I worked for a private company, but I was on the HBO Time Warner account. So every HBO, if you had an HBO show on DVD, like if you had a Sopranos DVD or Sex in the City, any of those big shows from that era, I was the one who typed out the captions and subtitles on it and made sure, like, the timing was right and did, like, the QC process on that.
Wow. That's mind-numbing.
You know what? It wasn't, like, sometimes, like, kids' shows were bad. Like, when it was, like, you know, 3 seasons of HBO's, like, Raggedy Ann dolls, and they're, like, stop motion, like, where is the pen? You found it. Like, that was horrible. And I would, like, smoke a bowl in my car and go back. Like, sometimes it was really interesting. Like, Sopranos was the most fun. When we get a season of Sopranos and it was, like, oh, the next, like, 2 weeks at work, 3 weeks at work, I'm just watching Sopranos all day. But it was a weird job, too, because, you know, we were working off of we had software that we could scan in the shooting script and then it would like start the work for us. Like it used a WAV file to like, okay, Tony's gonna start talking here, so that's Tony, and then we'll put it. But then I would have to go fix it and make it work and
make it accurate.
What I realized then, which is sort of trivia now, is James Gandolfini would make a lot of that shit up.
Oh really?
Not like important plot conversation, but like when he's like, come! Like, all that is just Gandolfini's riffing. Like, he never would follow the script. Anything of them with meats or anything of them, like, hanging out, busting each other's balls. Like, Gandolfini would just riff. And he was so good with that New Jersey accent, he could just do it.
Yeah, he was but such the character.
Right. But then I had to figure out, like, what the hell? What is Mousse de Joule? What? That's not a word.
Here you are. You're not a journalist. You're not a lawyer like your parents want. When you're translating Gandolfini.
I'm trying to figure out what the hell James Gandolfini has just said. And now you can go on the internet and look it up and, like, have that stuff he really was making up. Like, he was faking it, and they would be like, this is what a Jersey take on a Sicilian word would sound like, and he's, like, literally, he's they just were just going with it.
But you're unlocking the code.
So there was no answer. So I'm, like, sitting there with headphones trying to, like, Lives of Others it. I'm like Travolta in Blowout, like, what?
and so you're here, you slave away, and here it is, you come to Hollywood for your dreams, like we all do, and then you're doing this.
I was doing that, I did that for 3 years, and then the company got bought by Deluxe, and they were going to move to Burbank, and I lived in Culver City, and I was
like another world.
I was just like, I'm not moving from Culver City. I'm like, I'm not driving from Culver City to Burbank every day. I don't care about this job or like it. So I quit, and then I didn't do anything for a long time. That's when I ended up at the video store. So all of a sudden, I was like,
"That's right, you worked at it. You were that cliche. You're the video store guy."
And like at the tail, and when it was like video stores were dying out,
you tried to get into journalism as the building was burning down.
My timing just is horrible.
Get a job at Movies to Go.
Well, but it's interesting because the third act of this sort of story is that I was really early. Like, the only reason I'm sitting here with you now is because I happened to get into video and digital media way, way before most people realized it was going to be a thing.
Yeah, well, that's what I always talk about. It's like, the job I have now and the job I had to Screen Junkies didn't exist 5 years ago, so I didn't know I wanted it. But there were people like you, and I mentioned my good friend Jack Conway, who that guy was so early into that.
And yeah, for me, it was pure luck. It was not like I had some like early, like, it's not me being insightful. Because obviously, as you can tell from these other examples, that is not my thing at all.
That is not it.
I know. I'm
what
bad
did you get?
At,
like, what was the first thing to break through?
I was working at a video store.
Yeah.
This is late 2006. There, I see a Craigslist ad for this new website that's starting up, and they need researchers. So they just need people like, and I, it's really light on detail. So I go, and it's the interview is at this guy's house in Brentwood. I go, like, you gotta go around the pool or whatever. And we're in this weird, like, by this pool house, and he's pitching me on this idea. And at the time, the idea doesn't make a lot of sense to me. It's still, it did not end up working.
Right.
The idea was, like, at that time, you would search things on Google.
Yeah.
And Google results were not so great. The example would be like, let's say you looked up Paris hotels. You wouldn't get like the 10 best hotels in Paris that you want to stay at. You would get like maybe one or two listicles, and you would get ads, and you would get a lot of stuff, cheesy SEO. Google's fixed a lot of this. It's been 11 years. But back then, those Google results were not so great. So this guy's idea was, we're going to hire a writer to quick spend an hour, make a page of just the good stuff. And we'll post that instead. And so he just needed writers to do that.
So it wasn't quite a search engine. It was a search
assistant.
It was
sort of a search play, but it was like a search. It was like a curated search is what we called it.
Gotcha.
And so he just needed those people. And you would write a little like capsule, like, here's what a Paris hotel is, or here's who Bob Dylan is, or whatever. I was one of the first pages I did was Bob Dylan.
That's awesome.
But there was a big flaw in it, which is most of the things that people said, that was the biggest flaw.
It didn't work.
Well, I think the reason it didn't work was because most of the things people search every day that are actually valuable that you want to people to come search are time-based. It's not like I could make a page and then 6 months later you could look it up and it's still useful. Like Bob Dylan is and Paris Hotels is, but like most people are looking up like what's in the news today? You know, like Neil Gorsuch wasn't new. Like you can't prepare for that. It's just like here's a random guy who's super famous now and that's what everybody wants to know about. So that's why it didn't
work.
But that company was around long enough to do a lot of weird, crazy things. It was called Mahalo.
Oh, my gosh. I remember Mahalo.
Yep. The guy who started it was Jason Calacanis. It was his house.
Wow.
He just kept – he got a lot of investment in it, and he had a lot of ideas. And we ended up doing so many different things that I started doing video through that company.
Through it.
Well, and the really interesting footnote, the me feeling like I was – witness to history part of this whole story didn't come till years later. We had started making a lot of YouTube videos and having some success with it. I did a show called This Week in YouTube where it was just like weekend update, but for YouTube videos.
Yeah, yeah.
We would do one episode a week and count down like four videos because that was it. Like
yeah,
that
was all you could find.
The best of YouTube for that whole week would be four videos.
Right.
Everything else was just like people staring out windows or like filming their gerbil. Like it was just garbage. But we had a random guy who worked there. His name was Mark Burnham. I'll shout him out. And he came up with the idea, like, what if, like, Halo 3 was just coming out. And he was like, what if we recorded, screen captured me playing Halo 3.
Oh,
and
wow.
I'll show you where to find all these skulls. There's, like, these hidden skulls in the game.
Right.
And, like, I'll track down where every hidden skull is. We'll screen capture it. We'll put the tutorial on YouTube.
Wow.
And we were like, oh, that's a pretty good idea. That's good. Useful. That's a helpful idea. So we started a whole
team. No one will go for that.
Well, so we built out a whole team to make just those videos. But it was after that team came on board and they started working together.
Yeah.
They discovered, I'm not claiming credit. For the record, I'm not claiming credit for this. Yeah. I was working on other stuff. They were back there and they sort of discovered organically that people were just as interested in hearing what the team was doing and they're trying to figure out where the skulls were, as they were in, like, tell me where to find the skulls. And that team that was the Mahalo video game team, almost all of them now work on video game content online.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of them are at Defy. Like, a lot of the Smosh Games crew was the Mahalo video games crew.
That's, you're right. That is a ground
and it was really, like,
history.
And, I mean, we were discovering it day to day. We would see these videos, like, wait, us... That doesn't make any sense. The guys trying, the video we put up of them trying to figure out how to get through this part of Assassin's Creed got like 18 times more views than like how to get through it.
What do you think that is? Because that's at the beginning.
Yeah.
And we still struggle with it now at companies of what gets views and what's there. I always contend it's personalities and a journey versus information.
Well, there I think
you're describing that a little bit to me.
I think personalities is the key insight. Yeah. I mean, to me, and I'll take it one step back. I think a lot of what we in the content creation side of the internet forget is that the difference between the internet and like TV or radio or other broadcast media is that the internet is a back and forth. It's a conversation. Yes. And I think of it as like an attention economy. Like I'm paying you, like the people listening to this right now are paying us in terms of their attention. That's their currency. They're paying attention to what we're saying and they're listening to us and they're downloading it. They're giving you numbers, whatever.
Right.
But they want a little something in return. They want your attention. They want acknowledgement from the people who create the content that they're listening to because it's an exchange. Not one way.
It's an entirely intelligent next-level way to look at it starting from the beginning to now. And that's why through Twitter and social media, the interactions are important.
Everything. And I think so often Hollywood comes in and they're like, these YouTubers have this huge audience. What can we do? Put them in a movie. Put them in a TV show. And like, well, great. I'm happy for those people. And like, that's awesome. And a lot of YouTubers are super, super talented and belong in movies.
Right.
But I think they always forget that part, which is why a lot of those projects don't work, because their fans don't necessarily just want to see them be funny. They want to be engaged with them. They want to be doing something with them. They want to feel like a part of it.
I mean, that's like when I look at, Grace Helbig goes from one of the biggest YouTubers, has a show that's like the least watched.
I think I had some issues with the show, exactly. Like her bit makes perfect sense when you're watching her YouTube channel.
Yeah.
But it doesn't make sense when she's on TV. You're just removing that
you're adding
intimacy.
You're removing the intimacy and adding a layer between them and the audience.
Right. Well, and Grace can turn on her camera and go like, oh, my God, I'm not ready. And like, ugh, what am I doing? And like, look at this. And like, it's self-effacing. But it's like, because she's just in her house turning on her camera. And it's intimate and it's personal. And that's what people like about her.
Yeah.
And she's very funny.
Yeah, she is.
But then you give her a TV show. And like, well, we know that this isn't last minute. We know that you're on a set and that there's a camera crew and that it's a whole production. And so then we expect high professionalism, you know? Like, that's the difference. You can't do YouTube on TV and you can't do TV on YouTube. If you keep trying to do it and it doesn't work.
Yeah, it's so funny because TV and the bigger classic broadcast things they want, what digital's building. Mm-hmm. They understand something. They understand it's the future. And then we over in digital, where you and I, we want their money.
Yeah. It's like how every rock star wants to be a comedian and every comedian wants to be a rock star. Like, they just can't access what the other people are doing. I do think that's a big... my favorite example of this ever... I wrote a couple shows. I worked on a few shows for Machinima, which is how I got to know Jack Conway. And one of the shows they were working on that I was not working on, I just was aware of because it was being made at the same time, it was called Player versus Pain. And it was like a Spike TV. Imagine a Spike TV show.
Right.
And the idea was we're going to have a bunch of gamers and they're going to all be competing against each other, but we're going to do something uncomfortable and ratchet it up as they play.
As they play.
So like we're playing Mario Kart, but they're also wearing this thing that's going to like tug on their junk. And it's going to like tug a little bit harder on their junk every like 5 minutes.
Tugging on the junk is a good thing.
Listen, it's great. That's just pure entertainment. But the way Machinima did it was very high level, high production value. They got a soundstage. They set it up like it was a real Spike TV show, like American Gladiator, American Ninja Warrior. Like that's what it looked like. And the audience just flat rejected it. You would go to the comments, and it wasn't that the things that were happening weren't funny. People being hurt is just funny. Like,
endlessly
funny.
We all
think that's funny. It was that, like, too slick, too professional. What is this? This looks like Spike TV. This looks like MTV. Where's Machinima? They wanted the Machinima personalities. They wanted the Machinima that they knew, not this TV channel that was trying to intrude on what Machinima was.
Yeah, like with digital, it's like people get behind, like I said, again, the personality. So we're over at Collider, they're invested in what we do, and sometimes the information we put out, if it is too packaged, too nice, it seems like people, they don't want it. They'd rather have John Campy in his office with his glasses on talking into a snowball.
Because they know him.
Yeah.
They know him, and they feel like he is in a... a relationship with them. It's weird to say it that way. And I don't mean like a romantic relationship.
No,
but like they're a community. They're part of a community together. I mean, certainly at Screen Junkies you see this.
Yeah.
Like the fans who know me from Twitter or because they've seen me on some of the other shows, when I'm on Movie Fights, they're in my corner because they know me.
What's your team name? Do you have a team?
I don't have a. We were debating it the other day. I favored Lonatix. I think Lonatix is a good one. Parker came up with the Lon Rangers, which I think is good.
Okay, I can. I like
the Lon Rangers because it sort of has a baked in theme song. Like
yes,
you can hear it when the Lon Rangers come on.
Yeah.
Jack Shilby was trying for the Lon Burjacks, but I don't.
Oh, Jack Shilby.
Sort of, the pun is like 80% there, but not 100%. It doesn't totally click.
So they get behind. But yeah, you're right. They get behind you
because
and then,
they know you, and it's not. It's not fake. It's not like it's not like they're, you know, like that stalker thing where like, oh, I know Brad Pitt. I know like they actually do know me.
It's,
like,
we
talk on Twitter and like they've seen me and they know who I am.
It's like it's not like, but it starts to me. When I hear you talking to you're describing it so well, Lon, but like, I'm a big fan of Ryan Adams music.
Right.
And that guy's made me cry with his music. If I ever meet him, it's going to be awkward because.
Right.
Or case in point, one time I did meet E from Eels, and I'm a big fan of Eels.
He
lives around Silver Lake. And when I say meet him, I stood next to him. He's friends of a friend.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, do you want to shake hands with him? I was like, I can't. I've cried to this man's music. I can't do that. It's too awkward.
It's too intimate.
I feel as though I know him and he knows me, and that's not true. But in digital, so you take that same feeling of music, and we connect to music.
Mm-hmm.
And movies is different, though. It's this big thing. I'm hitting my mic all day today. You're right. Too early for whiskey.
Yeah.
but we're so connected. And that's what drives digital is listeners of me, the Knapsack Files, they are my friends.
They're listening to you all the time.
Yeah.
Like, this is an intimate way to get to know somebody. And I mean, I think you see it, like, I compare it to, I get way more excited now to meet or encounter in public people who are memes than celebrities. I think a lot of it is like, you just live in LA, you see enough celebrities, it kind of wears off on you. But like, I love Mad Men, and I met John Hamm, or I encountered John Hamm once.
Right.
And I met him, and it was like, oh my God, that's John Hamm. That was really cool. But it didn't feel like when I was at a South by Southwest party and I met Scumbag Steve. Like, I hugged Scumbag Steve. I had a couple drinks.
Sure.
But like, that was really like exciting. It feels like he's like an odd, like, I sort of feel like I know him in a weird way, even though I totally don't. It's just a picture of him.
Yeah.
But it's more, it's intimate because it's online. It's in my house in that way than like Mad Men is.
Mm-hmm.
Which is like Mad Men, he was in a soundstage, he was dressing up. Like, I don't know. To me, there's something different about it.
It is entirely, it is at its core why this is a different time when when, you know, unfortunately, you know, it sometimes it works badly where the social media is so makes everyone a star in their own head. And that's sometimes a bad thing. Yeah. Sometimes it takes them all the way to the White House. But, it's a bad thing on some things. But on other level, it's so connected. That's why I'll never talk overly bad about social media, because I have relationships with family members I wouldn't have had.
Absolutely. I really do. Front. Yeah. That's true of me as well.
And I owe that a lot. And so the same thing is the fandoms and the support. It's a weird thing. There's still a dividing line if you're a fan or that. But touring around with Screen Junkies and seeing them at conventions say, hey, we're going to do a show with Kevin Smith or Doug mm-hmm. Benson. And the crowd would... And then now here's Dan Merle, 500 people
go
on
nuts.
Their feet.
Exactly.
And I mean, that's where the power lies.
Right. And I think we were talking about me as like a kid and sort of loving mm-hmm. movies and TV and like feeling kind of isolated. And like I see younger people today mm-hmm. who have this outlet. Like they can right. find the like two or three other kids at every school across America
yeah.
who also likes the thing that they like and connect with them and form this little community. And that's why they love Dan, because he's part of that group that they've created for themselves of like, right. here's my island of like-minded people who get the things that I'm in. Yeah. And, sometimes it takes weird turns. Like, I think a lot of this, like, alt-right Trump yeah. stuff is, like, a weird turn. Like, that was another community of lonely, isolated
sure.
people who got together and
yeah.
they made sense to each other. And, like, I totally get that. I just think, like, at some point it got twisted in this weird way.
Well, because if you go in their feeds, just like if you go in another person's feed, you're surrounded by, you know,
right,
I'm not using the bubble, but it's the bubble term. But it's like, yeah, so you're going to feed off each other.
Well,
and
sure,
then
yeah.
if you go off the tracks, you might not know it.
And, I mean, that is true. There's, you know, there's groupthink and conventional wisdom mm-hmm. in sort of every community.
Sure.
And I mean, in the movie community, like I'm being, you know, yelled at on the movie fights comments today for,
you had like, an unpopular opinion.
Right. And I mean, to me, and this also comes from becoming a movie fan in relative isolation and not knowing a lot of other movie fans growing up. So I just formed my own opinions.
Yeah. Yeah.
That bugs me sometimes about the sort of the movie fandom in 2017 of like, there is kind of like a CW of like here's the conventional take on every movie and like that's correct and then it's like sealed away and if you violate it
yeah
and I'm not just talking about Screen Junkies, I'm talking about generally
in general
in the movie
society,
fan
yeah,
world
yeah movie fandom
and I think that's in, like that's more exciting when somebody's like
really
yeah well I mean that's what it's about like that's what's fun about movies in a lot of ways is like mm-hmm. you get to make up your own mind and like
well yeah that's the success of all these media discussion shows and movie fights
yeah.
I mean that's born out of what happens.
Well, but I even said something like this on Twitter the other day, and somebody wrote back like, yeah, well, there's like, no, movies are objectively good or bad. I'm like, man, I think like individual facets of movies are objectively good
right.
or bad. Like that shot is poorly composed. That shot is well composed.
Yeah.
But like, no, like I don't think movies are objectively good or bad. Like I think like it's whatever.
Yeah.
If I can argue it, then it's good.
Yeah, if you
know?
Can find something in it.
Neon Demon was the big argument. Like, I loved that movie. That was great. It was like, no, it's terrible. It's like, I think you're wrong. Like,
hey, man, one of my favorite comedies of all time is still Dirty Work. And
I love Dirty Work.
Dirty Work is...
That's correct. That's an objective truth. Dirty Work is very fun.
Cannot be debated.
That scene... It's just a good, like, this is where, like, a lot of the time I think it's too easy to just knee-jerk be like, well, that dumb comedy is stupid and bad.
Right,
like,
right.
That scene where they hide all of the fish, and then you just hear it play out in audio while they're standing there, and it's all in Norman Artie's faces. That's a really good scene. Like, that's a good, if that was in a much different comedy with a better pedigree, everybody would be like, that's a great scene. It's just because it's in a stupid movie.
An alleged stupid movie.
Right. It's just, well, I mean, I think that movie is, it's stupid,
it's pretty stupid,
but it's fun stupid.
Fun stupid.
I also love the part where Norm is just like, that ridiculous.
I love Norm MacDonald's cadence, his delivery.
Just ridiculous.
There was a time where I think I spoke like Norm.
Got a good mind to go to the warden about this.
It's the you're making me laugh because it's taking me back to a lot of Norm stuff.
Yeah, I love Norm.
His classic bit about his devil making his friend kill his family. Hey,
yeah.
It's me, Bob.
Hey. Yeah. So good.
Love it. We talk about Norm.
We could do a whole podcast on Norm.
Whole Norm podcast. I do want to talk about opinions. And you and I are in this space where opinions and nerd culture and geek culture has become a business. And it's become what sports were started in the 80s.
Sure.
You know, by 78, 79, 80, whenever ESPN kicks into full gear and is, goes from an experiment to a success. And it takes talking about sports from the barbershops and the bars to the TV, launches that.
Sports talk radio is what we do now. Yeah. For everything, but it was just for sports.
How does that, number one, how does that feel now? Because, again, I grew up a sports fan. I'm less of one now, but it's weird. I am a giant sports fan, a Yankee fan, Dolphin fan. Yeah. I don't watch it as much. I don't listen to stuff as much. I don't watch Colin Cowherd like I used to, or Dan Patrick like I used to, because at one point it was so much, I just was like, you know what? I'm going to not listen. I'm just going to watch the game and enjoy the game for the game. I do have a fear that movies and pop cultures could go that way.
Yeah. Well,
and at times it is.
I mean, I do. Yeah. I have this thought a lot because I don't think movies were necessarily individual movies. Like movies is a pastime. There's so many movies you could never, you can't watch them all. You could fixate on it your whole life. But I do feel like a 2-hour movie or a series of movies weren't really designed to be round the clock obsessions. And the fact that we're doing that to them now is like odd. And like, it doesn't necessarily serve the movies. Like I would probably enjoy Civil War. I didn't really like Captain America Civil War.
Sure.
Sorry to lob another truth bomb. But I think I would probably like it a lot more if I could have like heard a little bit about it, knew basics going in, watched it, talked about it for an hour or two, and then not had to keep thinking about it.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that in like a really devastating, mean way, but I just mean like it's just not designed to sustain a year of conversation. It's kind of a fun throwaway popcorn thing.
I'm in the Star Wars media world, you know, and there are moments where I'm like, I just don't want to give my take on Last Jedi anymore because I don't have one.
And you know, like and like those movies are best served. I've been talking about this a lot in a different, slightly different way about La La Land lately.
Oh, wait, let's do it.
Because I saw it. There was already hype. Yeah. I didn't see it that early, but I saw a few weeks before it like came out everywhere.
Sure.
JTE got me into a screen. Yeah, it was.
Oh, that powerful JTE.
He used his connections of just taking every movie invite that is sent out to anyone.
That almost made me spit out my water.
But when I saw it, it was just like, oh, there's this, it's huge, it's great, it's guided Whiplash, right? I was like, it did not yet have the like 14 Oscars, the film of the decade. And I'm just not sure that movie is best served by those expectations. It's just it's so light and so fun and so kind of.
Is it light and fun though?
Well, it does get dark at the end, but I mean,
spoilers for La La Land.
Yeah,
it's been on my mind.
We'll get into
I don't know. That's a pretty dark.
It's a very well. I actually think
ending.
I think the last act is a little bit darker than I think. I have a darker take on it than most people because my view of it was, you are in Emma Stone's perspective the entire finale epilogue part, except when he's playing the piano.
Mm-hmm.
And that vision that you see when he's playing the piano, that's her sharing in his fantasy of what might have been.
Okay.
So, like, she's got happy news. She achieved all of her dreams.
Right.
She's got a husband and a kid, and she's got this happy home life. And then they go see her ex, and he plays this really sad song about what might have been. And I think that it's like sad, and then she looks back at him and he puts on this smile.
Yeah.
But I'm not reading it as like, I'm also totally happy in my life.
No.
I'm reading that as like, Seb's a good guy.
Yeah.
And he's like, we had our moment and I'm not begrudging you and I'm going to smile at you to sort of end things on this graceful note. But he doesn't necessarily have everything he wants. He's got that club.
No, it's a sad ending to
but
it.
Yeah, like you, because here's the thing. Damien Chazelle could have put in a moment where there's a woman waiting off stage for, so she could have shown some indication that he also has a happy life at home and he doesn't. And I think the decision not to is like, maybe he doesn't. Like maybe he sacrificed and didn't get everything he wanted in the end the way she did.
You and I are on the same page, and it connects with me, and you can bring up all the romantic history and failures I have.
Sure.
But I connect. I got to say, I did not enjoy 98% of the movie. I recognized as I watched it, this is a good movie. I recognized everyone's done a great job. I didn't connect it to as much. It was good. But I'll sit at the end. I was like, oh, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. This is not what was advertised to me in the happy. This was not. Scott Mance didn't yell at me this sad ending. Scott Mance yelled about how beautiful this movie was.
Well, I think it is beautiful.
And it is beautiful.
It does have a. It does definitely have that moment at the end. Yeah. And I like what I like about that so much. And the reason I'm so convinced that my take is like the right one.
It's the right take.
Is Whiplash, because that's what Whiplash is also about. He also has to give up happiness and having a normal, stable life.
Right.
For his dream of drumming. And a lot of people read Whiplash as like, it's definitely like a sort of, it's like homo. So it's about like how he's in love with his drum professor.
Right.
And I mean, that element is there. It is definitely like kind of, you know, like homoerotic in some sort of ways or suggestive in some ways. That context is there. But that's not the, my primary reading on it is, that like at the end he realizes like, oh, J.K. Simmons was right. Like, in order for me to be as great at drumming as I want to be, I have to give up everything else that would potentially make me happy. And I think that's sort of what La La Land is getting at, too, that, like, they couldn't have ever been totally happy together because they would always have this, like, well, I didn't – I gave up my dream for this.
That smile broke me. The smile he gives her.
Right. Because I did not read it as, like, everything worked out.
I read it as he smiles at her, knows what they accomplished together as a couple, knows happy what she – he's very happy, and he's not like he's taking credit for helping her through or anything like that.
No, he's happy that she has her success.
Yeah. And he smiles, she walks away, and he kind of, there's a sigh, and he goes back to his life, and that's a sad moment. That's a heartbreaking moment.
Yeah, I agree.
It's dark.
I read it that way, too, that it was like, you know, he's not necessarily happier now than he was when they were together, but he recognizes that it wasn't going to ever be. And
it is what it is. It's a little bit of misery. And so, hey, here's an example. You and I just broke down La La Land impromptu for 5 minutes.
There you go.
That's the industry we're in. Mm-hmm. How it has a place. And again, we couldn't have imagined 5 years ago you were in there, 10 years ago getting in there, but when you're watching these guys play video games, you're not thinking at any point you're going to be on a Sports Center of movie news.
I mean I'm notoriously bad at like visualizing what the future is going to be, but no, I didn't. The video game,
he said in his journalism.
Yeah, the video game videos thing. I did not. I was not like, oh yeah, of course. Oh, everybody's going to want to watch other people play video games and like comment on it. Like I totally was not there. The Uber story is the best one. Well, I told you about Jason, my old boss, who was one of the early investors in Uber, and showed it to me early on before it was like Uber. And of course, he was like, you know, oh,
you want
check
in?
It out. Yeah, no, well, with my $3. But he was like, oh, check it out, like all the cars, and you're showing it to me. And immediately, first thing, I'm like, well, that's not. I mean, why would I get in some stranger's car? Like, what am I, an idiot? They're going to mug me. How are they going to know what I'm about? Like, they're going to want me to let me in my car. Nobody's ever going to do this.
You're an idiot, sir.
So, yeah, I don't know what I'm talking about. Clearly.
Clearly don't talk about.
Terrible at prognosticating.
Yeah. But we're here in this industry now, so
I fell backwards into it.
When'd you move on next to after Mahalo?
So I did Mahalo for a long time, and I ended up being on a bunch of the podcasts and video shows. We were doing a lot of both at once. We were making audio podcasts. We were doing video shows and podcasts. I mean, the video shows were basically video podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
Jason did a really popular one called This Week in Startups. It kind of was the granddaddy of a lot of the other stuff we did. So I ended up sort of leaving Mahalo, but staying with Jason, and we started This Weekend, which was a podcasting company with Kevin Pollak was the other partner.
Okay.
So he did Kevin Pollak's chat show, which I kind of helped out with a little. And then we produced like a whole bunch of other podcasts that I worked on about any you name it. I mean, social media topics, and we did one on iPad, which at that time was brand new. But we also did like reality TV, like a lot. Like I did a Mad Men show.
Yeah,
I was a big fan of Lost podcasts. Remember, like
I feel like
Lost was the show that really, in a lot of ways, at least from my perspective, gave birth to the like after show. Like we're gonna do a podcast where we talk about this week's Lost.
Yeah.
Those were the first ones I was listening to. So inspired by that, I started one about Mad Men.
Okay.
And we did a few others. And this was like, you know, about a year before like Walking Dead became Talking Dead. And
right.
It sort of blew up and blew became up. A huge genre.
Yeah, I think for me, Walking Dead was the one that really, really, really because Lost was early on.
Right. And Lost was like, I really feel like that might be the show.
That's the granddaddy of it. Yeah.
This movement. Yeah.
Because that was literally the water cooler.
Right. And it had so much. It's the perfect show for that because it's like there's so much like little juicy details to unpack. Like what's going on in the hatch? And like, what about this discovery? And what about this? Yeah. And it ended up all adding up to not much. But at the time, it seemed really tantalizing.
Yeah, well, and The Walking Dead has that. Game of Thrones has that. A lot of shows have that.
Game of Thrones for sure is great for a recap.
Yeah, and of course, any success we had with watching Thrones on Screen Junkies Plus was due in large part to you, sir. Yeah. I want to make sure that's publicly known because
it was a great team.
It was a very fun team.
Solid Thrones knowledge going into every week.
What's so impressive with you and your Thrones knowledge is you've never read the books.
No books, no.
And you could probably beat book readers in your knowledge.
I think three times. I've watched the whole show now three full times. And if you do that, that second time through was like, oh, everything gets unlocked. I cannot stress enough, if you are a fan of that show, you must watch it a second time through. It demands it. You really have to.
It's absolutely amazing.
I will talk to people and I will know in like a minute or two if you've rewatched it or you've just been through once.
Right.
Because
right.
I'll mention a name and you'll be like, huh? And I'll be like, too late.
How do you, and this is behind the scenes, changing the conversation slightly, mm-hmm. but in your work on Game of Thrones with me mm-hmm. And Michelle and Spencer and Trisha and the guests, it's where I really, really learned the strength of your ability. I already knew going in. I already knew what you were capable of here. But you have this amazing ability to watch an hour programming and pull themes, questions, concerns, and stuff out of it that I've never seen any other person pull out of.
Oh, wow.
How does your mind work? I'm trying to get into it. I mean, and to the listeners, especially if you're a listener of Watching Thrones, and unfortunately, I couldn't use every bit of thought starter or conversation starter you had because you sometimes had 4 pages.
Yeah,
What about this? And the show was only, Watching Thrones was one of the longest shows on Screen Junkies Plus because I couldn't shut up in time because I had so much to talk about. And it's a nature show, but you had a lot there. Do you just rattle this stuff off? How does your mind work? What's the hamster on the wheel doing in there?
I think it's just watching a ton of stuff. I mean, my take is always just like watch, lots of every kind of thing, watch older movies and foreign movies and TV shows and like stuff that even doesn't necessarily immediately appeal to you. Like those years I spent at the video store, that's really all of it. It's just you would watch 8 movies a day and you would just think about them a lot. And like I was also, I'm sort of, I guess, an analytical kind of thinker anyway.
Sure, that's part of your makeup.
But I was always trying to be like a writer too, so I was always kind of watching stuff with like, what do they do that I like that I'm gonna steal or repurpose or like that informs what I want to do.
Right.
And I guess it's just attacking it that way and like looking at it from like the, well, why would it be written this way? I think a lot of people, especially younger people that I'll talk with about movies, especially like, Screen Junkies, you meet a lot of people who are getting into movies, is like there's this weird assumption that things are in a movie just because. Like things happen in a TV show or in a movie just because like, well, that's what the guy wrote or like that's what happened or like that's how – like especially if it's based on a true story. Like when people watch movies that are based on like a biography of a famous person and then a thing happens in the movie, they're like, well, that must have been exactly how it happened in real life.
Fact.
And that's why it's in the movie. So you'd be like, well, analyze why that happened in the scene that way. Like why did the director choose to shoot it that way or like why did they leave this character out of that scene and like – people don't tend to ask themselves those questions because they're just like accepting what the movie is sort of giving them.
Okay.
But you have to. The only way to really dig into it is you have to ask those questions. That's the whole thing.
That's where you're at. That's where it comes from, and that's the difference between you and a lot of other people. I have some people that are great at too. Jack Conway, who now we've name dropped 3 or 4 times in the show, he's great at breaking down story. My friend Jessica and I can watch Game of Thrones, and she'll turn to me and have 14 questions about Jon Snow's behavior that I don't have because I'm like, he had a cool sword. It is definitely a mind in a makeup, but I see where it's coming. You're going inside as a writer, as a director, and asking those questions.
Well, I also think the first time you're ever, and this is, it's not like I'm like some old hat. Like I haven't worked that much in production, but if you ever go on a set, the first time you're on a set and you actually see how things are made and how intensely, insanely difficult it is to, like, make the composition, just what's in the frame that the camera's going to capture, look exactly right and get the details right to make it lit properly. And, like, you only have to see that once to be like, oh, every movie I've ever seen was made under these conditions. Like, the, like, the way that you're seeing it and what you're seeing was totally dictated by what they could make happen on the day. You know?
You're so right.
And so then, yeah, then you start thinking about, like, well, what else? Wow, what didn't they do? What decisions did they make? And, like, that's how the whole thing sort
of comes
together.
That's where you start breaking it down?
Yeah.
Oh, you're so good at it. You're so good at it.
All right. I do what I can.
So as we start to wrap up here, though, you and I can't predict the future of this business, but we have found ourselves here. Do you have, as you know, you're slightly younger than me, but we're in the same boat on Titanic. Yeah. We got in on the same raft. Do you worry or see where this industry is going? That's why sometimes I'm concerned about if the bubble bursts, and I'm not talking like the .com burst, but just like people get sick of breaking down movies for ad nauseum. Do you have any plans of action? Where are you looking? Because I'm trying to find.
Good man.
I don't know if I could be 50. I wouldn't mind being 50 talking about Star Wars, but I don't know if I'll be allowed to.
I'm not that guy. Like, this is this is one of the problems I think I've had in, like, my career.
Yeah.
Is that I'm very focused on finding something I like to do. There's not a lot that I like to do, and I've had a 100,000. We could have done a whole other podcast about all the jobs I've had in the same years we discussed that I didn't like. I'm just talking about the ones that I liked that led to something else.
Right.
So, that always is my primary focus. And I know, like, I'm getting older and I have to start thinking about, like, well, I can't be the 70-year-old guy who's like, you should, Michael Bay sucks. Like, it's not, I don't want to be that guy. But no, I don't really ever.
But at the same time, we don't know yet.
No, and I also.
Because this is new territory.
I gotta tell you, like, I think I'm just not an optimistic enough person to plan. I don't really know. Like, should we be planning for the Mad Max world or the world that we're in now? Man. You know,
a little column A, little column B.
Right, because that's the thing. Is like, I think if I was ever going to really worry about the future, I'd be like a doomsday prepper, not like, what if I'm going to get into a real estate? Like, there won't be any.
I'm heading to a cabin, man.
Yeah, just like, that's my version of planning. Is like, what happened? Like, Big Bear's got the lake, and that's where everybody skis. What about the other side of Big Bear? Who's on there? Could you just disappear? I'm going to go a little tangent. Then we can wrap up. There was like an article. It was like Esquire, Vanity Fair, or something. And it was about this guy who lived in this like mountain community, but he lived as a hermit for like 30 years.
Right.
And he would just like steal from people's backyards and sports stuff. And then one day he was like 62 and he had like some infection. He was just like, I can't. And he just showed up and he was just like, hey, I've been living in the woods. Help me with my health care.
What's been going on?
And in a weird, weird, dark place in my brain, I'm just like, I get it.
I totally get it.
I totally get that. I get that guy being like around my age and being like, you know what? Fuck all this.
I'm going to go
in a ditch and find a tarp to cover me, and I'll bring some comic books, and I'll be fine.
I'm telling you, I've had that thought recently, not too seriously, but and people know me as a depressive person. It's not that side of it. It is just there's a little bit of looking around, and the world's on fire, and a lot of people have opinions on what my job is or what it should be or who should be on my shows and who should this and that, and it's all well and good, and I'm here to help, and like you said, I'm here to entertain as best I can, and if I don't do it, I'm out. But there's this, in the back of my head, there's this like Will Ferrell sketch of me flipping over a table and just going to the wilds of Montana.
I do. And just, it's not like the depressed side, because I struggle with anxiety and depression too sometimes. That side of me is just I want to just be in my bedroom. I don't want to leave the house or whatever. It's not like I want to just get away. Like, but there is that side of me that especially lately.
Yeah.
Where I'm just like, I could see how this would just be. Like, it's too much. It's just
too much.
It's too much.
It's too much. The world keeps spinning and spinning and spinning. Yeah. And I'm just like,
I don't know what to do.
You know, I have a friend who's pretty big in the voiceover industry. And he is now spending more time, number one, out of California or actually in a cabin about 2.5 hours north of here, just taking pictures of the stars.
Yeah.
And it is that might be my new life goal.
Even just like, you don't even have to go that that far. It's not like you got to get totally off the grid. Like, I'll go to Idlewild for two or three days, and dudes are like, well, this is delightful. I never want to go back to Los Angeles.
What does Lon Harris do when he's out there in the middle of nowhere? You don't watch movies or anything? You just turn off the mind?
No move. To me, that's part of the whole point. Yeah. It's like, and I love movies and TV shows, but I'm just surrounded by it constantly.
Sure.
So what's nice about like a weekend in Idlewild or something is that you're unplugged.
You're unplugged.
You're not watching movies constantly in TV shows. You're just like, I don't know, reading or hiking or walking around and just like shooting the shit with people. Go like, let's walk to town and get a sandwich.
Yeah, that's like my hometown. When I go up to Pismo or my folks in the village of Arroyo Grande, tiny little village, and looks like Stars Hollow on Gilmore Girls.
Oh, Arroyo Grande.
Yeah, that's my hometown. My home stomping grounds. And so we'll go to the village. But like my poor folks, I just don't talk much. I just sit there in silence because it's just I don't hear any sounds anymore. I don't hear anyone giving their hot take on Game of Thrones.
Right,
I don't hear relaxing. I don't know who's Ray's parents are, and I don't have to answer.
Yeah.
And I just like it, and I love, and to those listening, I love doing that stuff.
Sure,
and I like coming back to it.
It's not I think it's balance, you know. It's just like that stuff was never meant to be all consuming, and we've made it that way because we can, and I get it.
Such an interesting take, Lon. It's a smart take, which I would expect any less from a genius like you, according to Jack Conway and me. But yeah, a lot of this stuff, even Star Wars.
No,
was not built to be 24 hours a day.
It was designed to be one movie. Like, he thought he had a good idea for a movie. Yeah. And then, you know, a trilogy and a franchise. And I'm not saying, like, don't love the shows and read the books.
Yeah,
all of it. Like, it's great. And
I love it. I'm wrapped up in it.
And if it's your hobby, fantastic. Yeah. I spend a lot of time doing really dumb things. I watched Rick and Morty, like, 8 times, all the episodes. Like, I'm not judging it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it is weird that we now have this expectation for entertainment to just sustain...
Yes.
All the time.
It's like sometimes the answers in Star Wars, when you have big questions, are, oh, George didn't know in 1974 that this world would be built around his thing he scratched down on a notepad.
Yeah. And that's where we were talking, too, about, like, you know, why are things in movies the way they are as opposed to another way, and that's how to sort of access them and think about them. And, like, we sort of purposefully try to undo that. We, like, delusionally pretend that that's not happening. And, like, no, how can we can explain this in canon. And, like, Rogue One even did, and I liked it. But Rogue One even does this a little bit. Like, oh, no, that's not like a plot inconsistency. That's like Mads Mikkelsen did it, you guys. And it's like, I don't – it is that way because it's that way. And that's an interesting way to think about it. You don't have to explain it all.
I'm telling you, cabin. We'll be in that cabin in a short while.
It's really nice. I think it's – well, because I didn't grow – I grew up in cities.
Yeah.
You know, we lived in like a suburb of Philadelphia, but it was still like a city. It wasn't like living in the country. And then Orange County and Los Angeles ever since. So I've never really had that. It's really nice to go like visit it.
Yeah. I could see you doing well in the wilderness. You got a wilderness man look.
Not
great.
Like on my own, like with a store nearby.
Oh, I'm not a camper either. I'm not like Ryan, the camera guy at Screen Junkies, who goes
– Oh, no,
who
yeah.
goes and takes his fiancée – up to, I don't even know if they're engaged yet. Maybe they are. I can't remember. Ryan, are you, if you're listening? And they go out, like, and they find some trailless wilderness.
Right.
And they camp for 3 days.
He's doing the, like, Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible 2, like, just climbing up a mountain with his two bare hands.
And my idea is going to the grocery store, picking up a sandwich, and parking in Griffith Park and not getting out of my car.
If you've been to Idlewild, like, there are roads and electricity. There's nice restaurants. Like, it's not, we're not talking about that. I know, I'm just making it sound like I'm Survivor Man. Something. And it's like, no, I'm not like gutting a fish.
Oh, man.
I'm
well,
just, like, in a nice cabin.
You do amazing work, sir. Behind the scenes, I'm glad you get in front of the camera. And you always have been. Your George R. R. Martin is very underrated in the pop culture landscape.
It's hard to compete. Nick Mundy
it's hard
also
with Mundy.
A great George R. He gives great George R. R. Martin.
And there's a lot more to talk to you about. I'd love to do more with you, and I'd love to have you on Life Ranked. I think you and I did not even get into our loneliness.
We didn't. It's
we
true.
Didn't. And I think two depressive guys like us who can give ourselves some kudos and some hand claps because we didn't go that route.
It's true. We could have.
This could have been easily. 45 minutes about how horrible we think we are to ourselves.
We stayed.
Or maybe that's just
we stayed pretty professional.
We stayed pretty good. We got a great discussion on the digital media world. Lon, where can they follow you and all your adventures?
Well, go to Twitter @LONS. That's where Twitter's my primary share. sharing platform,
which
online.
Is amazing. And I know Andy Signore's always been jealous of your handle. You got there early.
Yeah.
You got there.
It was again. Yeah. I was working at Mahalo for that guy Jason, and he's very good at being like up on what all the stuff was. He had gone to South by Southwest. I want to say that year. I'm sure somebody will correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was 2007 was the year at South by where Twitter like
seems
made
right.
a huge splash and everybody was into it and sort of started using it.
Yeah.
He came back and was just like, everybody sign up for this thing. Trust me, you're going to want to get in on it.
Right.
And then, everybody was getting like 3-4 letters.
Yeah.
There just weren't that many people.
Yeah. So follow at Lawns. There's so much that you do. Any big things you want to talk about, promote?
I'm on movie fights this week, so you could look out for that. I'm trying to get some other podcasts of my own going, but it's too early to promote yet, so I can't.
Too early to promote, and you're too busy providing research for other podcasts.
I work on 18 other people's podcasts.
18 other people's stuff. Well, hopefully your time will shine. That was a great discussion on digital media, how to get there, and spending times in the wilderness, and your ability to kind of translate James Gandolfini. That's some skills, sir.
Yeah.
I hope you come back, and you can stick around. We're going to have a live rank that you and the Knapsack Files podcast we will hear in a little bit as well. We're going to release that. It's going to be a fun one. So that is that for me. You can follow me at Ken Knapsack. Don't forget to like the Knapsack Files Facebook page. You can like my official Facebook page as well. Subscribe and rate and review if you're on iTunes. Do me that favor. Rate and review on your iTunes. That definitely helps the podcast. Don't forget we have the Patreon page if you want to support the feed as we grow in 2017. There's a lot of things you can enjoy if you sign up for that. I appreciate that if that's something you want to do. So until next time, for Lon Harris, for Ken Knapsack, we will see you in that cabin in the woods.